Hi, welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm your host, Christina Fryer. Today we're talking with Yarimar Bonilla, author of the new book, Non-Sovereign Futures, French Caribbean Politics in the Wake of Disenchantment, published this year by the University of Chicago Press. The book is an ethnography of labor activists in Guadeloupe, which is one of France's overseas departments, and these labor activists are creating alternative forms of politics that are not bound by the question of sovereignty. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hi, and welcome back to New Books in Caribbean Studies. Today I'm here with Yarimar Bonilla, who is the author of the very new book, Non-Sovereign Futures, French Caribbean Politics in the Wake of Disenchantment. Yarimar, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you. So just going to start with some introductory questions. These are the typical questions that we start with here at New Books. So what led you to become an anthropologist? And then tell us how you came to this specific project on focusing on Guadeloupe and labor activists there.
Okay, great. Well, that's a tough question. I feel like I've been an anthropologist for so long, I don't remember making the choice. But I guess when I was in graduate school, I was doing my master's in Latin American studies. And I thought my concentrations would be political science and history. But I didn't really like my poli-sci classes. They were mostly very oriented towards predictive modeling and, statistic regressions and all these kind of algebraic equations to kind of predict human behavior. And I didn't find that very gratifying. And I just started taking elective courses in anthropology. And I really liked the kind of flexibility of the discipline, its interdisciplinary nature and what it allows. So I became interested in that. And then I found out about my mentor's work, Michel Rolf Trio, and wanted to work with him. And I think there was also a little bit of, well, if he's an anthropologist, that's what I want to be. And so that's when I went to the University of Chicago to work with him. But at that time, I still didn't know that I would write about Guadeloupe. I thought my work would be about Puerto Rico, but he kind of convinced me of the value of stepping outside of your own society, which is kind of a classic anthropological move also. And so I began exploring different parts of the Caribbean, just reading more broadly. And I became really interested in the French Caribbean, not because of its stark difference, but actually because of its similarity to Puerto Rico. And I decided I wanted to think about questions of colonialism and the empire in a context that was different from the United States. So to kind of break out of the U.S.-centered context that as a person of Puerto Rican background, that was a given for me. So to kind of think about these questions in a different frame. And so that's how I became interested in Francophone studies and in Guadeloupe in particular.
So then tell us a little bit about Guadeloupe. It's an overseas department of France. And for listeners who might not be familiar with that term, can you tell us what that means?
So it has, I say that it has a relationship comparable to that of Hawaii to the United States. So unlike Puerto Rico, which has an ambiguous status, it's a commonwealth, it's not fully incorporated into the U.S., Guadeloupe is fully incorporated as a department, which is the system in France that is similar to states in the United States. So they have French citizenship, they have representation in parliament, and they have, in theory at least, all the rights and duties of French citizens.
So would it be inaccurate then to say that Guadeloupe is still in some sort of colonial relationship, or is that terminology not useful in this situation?
Well, that's a question that's debated in Guadeloupe and beyond. So some people think that a lot of the economic, social, and racial foundations of colonialism remain in place, and that incorporation into France didn't eliminate those disparities. And other folks argue that departmentalization was a form of decolonization, and that Guadeloupe is no longer a colony since it is a full part of France. So that is an active and ongoing debate.
Oh, interesting. So, but the way that you phrase it in the book is that Guadeloupe is a non-sovereign state, and you note that Guadeloupe and Martinique, of course, are presented as sort of anomalies within the Caribbean. But actually, you say that the majority of the Caribbean islands are, in fact, non-sovereign. And even those, and I think you're making this argument implicitly, that even those states that are technically independent also themselves have fairly little sovereignty. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, no, that is exactly what I argue. So rather than getting into a debate about Guadeloupe's colonial or non-colonial status, I'm more interested in thinking about how its status is similar to that of independent states. So how I think about non-sovereignty in multiple ways. So first of all, I do try to bring to the, you know, foreground these societies that have been thought of as anomalies and exceptions and unique and singular, and to think about how there's a large number of societies in the Caribbean that don't fit the model of the nation state. So Guadeloupe, Puerto Rico, Curaçao, there's a large number of them, and I argue that, in fact, the majority of Caribbean societies are not independent nation states. But beyond that, I'm also trying to think about what sovereignty has meant in the Caribbean more broadly, across time and across different, you know, linguistic regions of the Caribbean. And I argue that the promise of sovereignty, of post-colonial sovereignty in particular, has never really been achieved in the Caribbean. And so even nominally sovereign states still struggle with the legacies of colonialism, still struggle with the imposition of foreign economic markets, economic imperatives. And so I'm trying to think about the Caribbean as a whole, as a kind of non-sovereign archipelago, borrowing from Antonio Benitez Rojo. I argue that there is a kind of non-sovereign island that repeats itself with certain particularities in each place. So I try to not collapse the differences across the Caribbean, but to think about how we can develop a theory of sovereignty that can encompass the Caribbean as a whole and help us think about the challenges of sovereignty throughout the Caribbean region, rather than thinking about exceptions and then, you know, in a way that reinforces a norm that has never existed. So I argue that this kind of sovereign, you know, homogenous, politically stable society has always been a myth, not just in the Caribbean, but beyond.
Right. And I think this is quite an interesting argument, and certainly one that I think is going to reshape how I approach my modern Caribbean survey. So you say that this promise of sovereignty has never really been reached. Is this the disenchantment that you're referring to in the title?
Yeah. So, well, I talk about disenchantment, yes, in several ways, but I suggest that there's also a widespread disenchantment that isn't just in the non-independent Caribbean. So I say that throughout the Caribbean, there is disenchantment with the sovereignty project. So in places like Guadeloupe and Puerto Rico, that looks like a rejection of independence, because that project has become a kind of future past, in as David Scott would suggest. But even in the independent Caribbean, I argue there's also a significant disenchantment with the promises of sovereignty as, you know, as they were packaged in the post-war era. And I argue that throughout the Caribbean, populations are searching for alternative political forms and alternative forms of politics. So this is what I describe as non-sovereign politics,
right,
which are social movements that are not focused around state formation and are not focused around the attainment or the consolidation of state power, but that do still search to create new alternatives, new forms of community, and new relationships to power, both locally and globally. And that I see, you know, I don't do this work in the book, but I do see connections between what is happening in Guadeloupe and the kind of social movements that are sprouting up in other parts and throughout the Caribbean region, but also in other parts of the world today.
So the non-sovereign politics that you're describing, your sort of site of study in the book, is this long history of labor activism in Guadeloupe? And I think this moves us into chapter one. So how did nationalist struggle and then, I guess, post-nationalist struggle become tied so closely to labor activism in Guadeloupe?
So, yes, I in the book and precisely in chapter one, I examine the kind of rise of this new form of labor activism. Now, this is something that is particular to the Francophone context, given the you know, the importance of labor in France more broadly, and the legal possibilities for collective bargaining in the French Caribbean. So there's a reason why labor, it becomes a fertile site in this place and not in other parts of the Caribbean where labor unions have been stamped out, you know. So in the I examine how in the early parts of the 1900s, most French Caribbean populations, they supported integration with France. But so after the moment of departmentalization in 45, almost immediately there was significant disappointment with that project. And as Antillean migrants moved to mainland France to work and help rebuild after the war, they experienced all sorts of discriminations as documented in famous texts like Franz Fanon's White Skin, Black Mask. Sorry, Blacksman, White Mask. And then at the same time, you have in the French Antilles the arrival of all these metropolitan émigrés from France through what Césaire described as genocide by substitution. So it's in that period where the promises of integration quickly lose their purchase that Antillean populations became more radicalized. And this is also the period where you have independence struggles throughout the Caribbean and throughout most of the former colonies. So in that moment, there's a rise of nationalist activism, and that is seeking independence, and they were engaged in armed struggle. They had strong connections to Cuban insurgents and Nicaragua movements and different kinds of movements, Algeria and beyond. But around very quickly, by the 1960s, there was significant repression of those movements by on the part of the French state, and they became very fractured and went underground. And a splinter group from those movements began organizing sugar workers in both Guadeloupe and Martinique, focused more specifically on Guadeloupe. And through that work with the sugar workers, they kind of turned into a labor movement. So it's not that they really set out to become a labor union. It's that, again, there were certain political possibilities available through syndicalism that were not available through other forms of struggle. And so in the 1970s, you have the rise of this new form of labor activism that is engaged in labor struggles, but is fusing that together with the politics of memory, the politics of language, you know, revitalizing the Creole language, revitalizing local music, and it became a kind of cultural nationalist movement similar to the kind of cultural nationalism that was taking place in other parts of the Caribbean, where you had kind of folk Caribbean practices becoming consolidated as as a kind of nationalist culture, a national culture.
Right.
You have a similar process going on in Guadeloupe through the work of these labor activists and cultural activists. So that's around the period of the 1970s where they became very strong. And so they have continued to grow in strength and support. And in the book, I trace their development all the way up to a major general strike that they launched in 2009.
Right. And we'll certainly get there. That is the last chapter of the book. How did... Because it seems by the time you're doing field work in Guadeloupe in the early 2000s, I believe, is that correct? Your first?
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. excuse me. It seems that by that point, the labor activism has been somewhat decoupled from nationalist politics. And you write that sovereignty, basically, or the idea of sovereignty as a political, as something to take political action towards, becomes taboo. How does that happen?
Well, I think increasingly independence becomes a kind of foreclosed option. So even though there's still a strong number of people who talk about independence and support it, at times what they mean is something broader than just political independence. So they, you know, I talk in the book about how sovereignty is a kind of native category in the Caribbean for thinking about cultural sovereignty, food sovereignty, sovereignty of the imagination. And so there's still a very strong support for those, for that kind of sovereignty, but not as much for political independence. And in part because it's imagined as untenable, in part because it's imagined as undesirable, and also given the fact that such a large number of Antillians live in France, some people estimate about 45% of the Antillean population lives in France. A break with France is not imagined to be possible. And so this is part of my interest in the book for thinking not just about Guadeloupe or more broadly in the Caribbean, about the lack of language for other political projects.
Right.
And so that's why I use the term non-sovereign, not just because it's a rejection of sovereignty, but because it's the search for something other than the kind of post-colonial sovereignty project. And so that's the kind of politics that I saw on the ground. And so even if many folks, they would say that they want sovereignty for Guadeloupe, but they would say that they would want it even if it's under the French flag. So what they mean is not necessarily a rupture with France, but a search for other kinds of sovereignty. And so I also examine in the book how in that move, the figure of the Maroon becomes very important, and how there's a turn to this kind of alternative model of sovereignty that is still in entanglement with the colonial society. So
right.
It's not a complete kind of rupture, but that it offers a model for thinking about how you could have certain kind of sovereignty within the context of entanglement.
Yeah, and let's actually move into, this is in chapter two, and I'll note that as a historian, I was particularly taken with the ways that that labor activists engaged with and manipulated history to their own purposes in really fascinating ways. And you open chapter two with this interview with somebody by the name of Lucas, is that correct?
Yes.
Who basically describes labor activists as Maroons, but he has a very specific definition of what Maronage is. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so for Lucas, Maronage is not just the formation of a separate community, but it's a form of coming and going. And so it's about an epistemic rupture with the logics of the system. And it was through that interview that I became more interested in the history of Maronage. This was not something that I had set out to study. And what I wanted to portray or convey in the book is how the meaning of Maronage shifts over time.
Right.
So part of what I want to show is how Maronage is an important political category for Caribbean populations, but the content of that category is not stable. And so for different political generations in different problem spaces, the meaning ascribed to Maronage, the way it's imagined and the work it's made to do changes. And so I look at how before, in the early 1900s, Maroons were imagined as boogeymen. They were not romanticized. They were not heroes. They were imagined as escaped convicts and dangerous characters. And it is with the rise of the nationalist movement that then the Maroon figure becomes revalued and imagined as a hero, as a nationalist hero, but in a way that aligns with the project of post-colonial sovereignty. Maroons were imagined as building separate nation states, almost separate communities that were independent and not in relationship with the colonial system. But I examine how more recently and at present in Guadeloupe, the figure of the Maroon has been reimagined once again. And so at times compared to kind of the urban trickster, who is navigating the informal economy. And also the Maroons are now imagined as being in a different kind of relationship to plantation society, not just breaking ties, but questioning the logics of plantation society and also drawing from its resources when necessary. And so each of those interpretations of Maronage, they are substantiated by the historical record, but they pull on a different thread in a way and create a different narrative about Maronage that responds to the political needs of different moments.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating the way that Lucas is framing Maronage actually seems to correspond in a certain way with some of the historiography on Maronage. There's a very sophisticated understanding of what Maronage is that certainly, you know, even 50 years ago in the scholarship, we wouldn't have found. And it strikes me that this is actually a good moment to move us back quickly to something that you mentioned in the preface, I believe, which is your methodology and how you are trying to use the interviews that you did, the field work that you did, use these voices as analysis rather than anecdote. Can you say a little bit more about how that might differ from standard approaches in anthropology and why you chose to do it this way?
Sure. Well, first, let me say one more thing about my approach to these historical narratives.
So absolutely.
So they tie to the historical record, as you suggest, but I try very carefully to not do what some have described as a kind of verificationist anthropology, where I would then, you know, connect what my informant said to material in the archives as a kind of validation for their theories. So I tried to shy away from that, even while at the same time I did try to point to the resonances mm-hmm. with the historical record. And so precisely the way my approach is guided by what I explained in the preface of this way of approaching my informants as theorists. So I tried to put this as a challenge to myself. So when I cite them, when I draw from them, I treat them the way I would treat other scholars in a similar way, as authorities at times. Sometimes I question what they say, and then there are moments in the book where I have disagreements with my informants and I push back on their reading of Guadalupean society. But I argue that this is how we should approach not just informants, but how we should approach theorists, all our interlocutors, so that there should be moments of convergence and departure. And so with Lucas's vision of Marnage and that of the other folks that I cite in the book, I try to put them in relationship to how historians have debated about Marnage and how other theorists have and thinkers have thought about the historical record. And I try to do that throughout the book. And I do think it is a bit of a departure from the way, voices are used within ethnography, which is, it's been untheorized to a certain extent what the role of native voices are in the text. I cite Trillot, who asks a provocative question, are they there, just to add flavor, character? What is their value?
Right.
And so I tried to think carefully about what they were contributing and to make room for them, not just as evidence of my argument, but as folks who have arguments of their own. And so I wanted the reader to feel like they were in conversation with the folks in Guadalupe, as also with Trillot, with Benitez Rojo, with myself, in thinking about the Caribbean region, and that it could be a kind of dialogue with these multiple voices that are each well poised from their own position to tell the reader about this place.
And I think that really comes across quite well throughout, especially in chapter 3, which is the first of, you talk about two sets of strikes in the book, or you focus on two sets of strikes in the book. And the first is this sugar strike. Chapter 3 is called Life on the PK. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, you are.
This is earlier in the 2000s, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes.
And can you talk about what this strike was about, how long it went on, and the outcomes of it?
So, yeah, the Sucre strike that I cover in Chapter 3, it lasted an entire calendar year.
Wow.
And, yeah, so it was not entirely rare. There are many strikes, yeah. But during the time I was there, it was definitely an opportunity. And there was something about these workers. I think the time that I met them, that they were just so insightful about their experience. And so they had and about his visions of the strike, and he becomes the theorist for this strike, and he wasn't even necessarily talking about them when he talks about the importance and the kind of mechanisms of the strike in Guadalupe. But it's just that in some ways they became kind of, their process was very emblematic of the way Max and others envisioned the strike. So when they went on strike, they weren't entirely sure about how long it would last. They didn't have a good sense of what they were getting themselves into, and it was only through that process that they realized what it meant to be on strike and how it really changes your relationship to Guadalupean society. So they began experiencing everything differently. I mean, the the first thing is that they don't have a salary. So they didn't have a salary for over a year. And a lot of people in Guadeloupe assume that the union pays off workers so that they can sustain these long strikes. They were not paid off. There were certainly acts of solidarity, and they would sell food sometimes on the piquet or do these kind of lunches, and people would come and contribute, and they would, you know, raise funds at times. But for the most part, they were learning what it was like to live with a different relationship to this society that is very much driven by consumption. And so to be kind of taken out of that consumption economy, that was already a big deal. And then they were also in this, I talk about this kind of liminal space that they inhabit between work and leisure, where they go to their job every day, but they're not engaged in their usual production of, you know, of labor. They are sitting around in these quiet spaces talking about what they were going through, talking about their employer. And they were also in a different kind of community, because there were no longer the kind of divisions between the people who deliver the goods and the people who produce them, the different shifts. They were all kind of together and forming this kind of new community on the picket line. So it was a very, I try to not romanticize the process, because some people lost their jobs. Some people lost their spouses. They went through a lot of difficulty during this time.
Right.
But somehow, and I try to give a sense of all that in the book, but yet when I talk to them, they would still have a lot of nostalgia about that time on the picket line. And one woman who I interviewed, she describes it like a love affair. Like even if it ends badly, you still kind of remember the good parts of it and those moments of community and bonding that they had. So I try to convey a sense of that. And this is part of what makes anthropology different from other disciplines that have tended to study social movements, and particularly labor studies. They tend to be very dry and very focused around outcomes. So what did they gain in terms of wage increases or reduced, you know, work periods, etc.? But my focus is more on how are they transformed as individuals during this process. And so I try to get at those subjective transformations in my description of the strike.
So if we revert quickly to the drier forms of labor studies, what were the outcomes of the strike in terms of wages, in terms of the issues that they were striking over at the beginning?
Well, they had a restructuring of their work condition of the kind of forms of payment. So it's not fresh in my mind. It's in the book, but like the drivers, for example, they became paid under a new system that was not based on the time that they worked, but on other things. And then there were also salary increases for some of the people in other parts of the industry. But what I found was that, so even though they had certain gains, the company also did a kind of de facto downsizing. And
right.
So certain positions were eliminated. And so even though they had supposed improved work conditions, some of them were working longer hours at the end of the day under the new formulations. And then other things that they gained in writing were not actually applied.
Of course.
And so I haven't followed up recently, but the last time I had talked to them, they were trying to figure out if they would go on strike again to have those things applied. How could they, you know, they realized that that labor movement is not a kind of moment, but it's a kind of ongoing process. That is not, okay, we signed the agreements and now everything is good and we no longer have problems in our workplace, but rather that they had to sustain the energy of the strike and to keep meeting and to continue to be a kind of important presence in their workplace. And when I kind of concluded my research, they were still figuring out how to do that.
And it seems as though there's a way that the sort of disappointment with some of the outcomes actually channels new forms of politics and new forms of political strategy. And you talk about this to some degree in chapter 4, which is the hunger strike of a labor activist by the name of Michelle Matasami. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, Michel Malasami.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he goes on strike after after being arrested. And I'll ask you to give us a little bit more about his story. But it seems as though in response to that strike, the union activists, took on a different set of tactics that actually confused and confounded the entire island. So let us, give us a little bit more about this pretty interesting figure, Malasami, and then the union response.
Yeah. So in the book, chapter three is the one about the Sucre workers, and I kind of leave them aside, you know, for a minute and kind of leave them trying to figure out what to do next. And it is, like you say, that disappointment fuel later participation, because the Sucre workers and everyone in the book kind of comes back at the end to participate in the large 2009 strike. So I kind of examine how different things that were happening in society then converge in 2009. So with Michel Malasami, part of what was interesting about the Malasami strike was the moment in which it occurred was a time when the union was rethinking its relationship to the media. And so it was the moment when blogs were emerging and different forms of kind of new media were appearing on the landscape in Guadeloupe. And so Michel Malasami, he was captured is a little bit strong. He was arrested and placed in jail, but not sentenced for his participation in previous labor strikes. He had been accused of certain charges of destruction of property, etc. And so he went on a hunger strike to protest his arrest. And it became a very mediatized affair, and it lasted over a month that he was on this hunger strike. I can't remember now if he was, I think he was drinking water, but not eating. And so in the book, I examine how the labor activist kind of utilized this strike as a kind of form of destabilization, that creating a kind of heightened crisis in Guadeloupe, where people were afraid not just of what would happen to Michel Malasami, but also they were in a constant state of waiting to see what the new reaction of the union would be. So I look at how this form of protest, the hunger strike, which is in a way very passive, you're not acting upon, you're kind of ceasing activity. And it relates to the forms of the strike that is also about a kind of cessation of activity. It created a kind of feeling of social crisis. But it also, it spanned beyond just the folks in the union. Other people became very concerned about Michel Malasami and involved in the strike. And there were young people who were arrested for their participation in protest acts. And so the Malasami moment was a kind of precursor to what would be seen later in 2009, where broad segments of society would become involved and the media would play a very definitive role.
Now, Michel Malasami is of Indian descent. And you talk about the way that his ethnicity also got bound up in sort of the media spectacle. Can you tell us a little bit more about what his being of Indian descent means in a place like Guadeloupe?
Yeah. So the Malasami moment, I also look at how it kind of opened up conversations for race and ethnicity and also gender that are not usually part of union events. And in terms of what Malasami's Indian identity means in Guadeloupe, it was actually an open question, because what I argue is that in the French Caribbean, the Indian identity is a bit vacuous, and it can be kind of filled with different content. And so on the one hand, he was compared to, he was described as the son of Gandhi and imagined as this kind of symbol of peace and transcendence. But then at other times he was described as a kind of, you know, more violent hothead because of his ties to the union. And I look at how the labor activists who were carrying out his solidarity campaign, they played on the malleability of Indian identity in Guadeloupe to portray him in different ways as kind of both a hero and a martyr that people could rally around.
So, in the interest of time, I'm going to move straight to the 2009 Guadalupe strikes. But I do want to note for listeners that Chapter 5 is another example of the way that labor activists are engaging with and manipulating history. And it's a very interesting chapter about this tactic called memory walks and ways that labor activists are really reconnecting with a certain version of the past. But in Chapter 6, you talk about the 2009 strikes in Guadalupe, and these were on a massive scale. These became international news. Certainly the French government was forced to respond. Can you let us know, or tell us, I should say, what these strikes were about and how they got to be on such a massive scale as opposed to, say, the sugar strike that you mentioned in Chapter 3?
Why it reached such a mass scale?
Yes.
Well, part of it was that already with Michelle, with the Madasami affair, there was the creation of these new organizations that were outside of the union that became charged with issues of cultural memory, historical politics, and so they're the ones that are organizing, for example, the memory walks in Chapter 5.
Right.
And so then in Chapter 6, I talk about how those organizations, the cultural arm, I describe as the cultural arm of the union, they allied with other groups that were like consumer advocate associations, organizations interested in the rights of disabled folks in Guadeloupe. And there were 48 different organizations that partnered up to carry out this labor strike, which was not, it was not a labor strike, it was a general strike. And when it originally began, there was not a clear sense of what it would be, and it didn't even have a name. It was, the journalist described it as the Coalition for Guadeloupean Purchasing Power, because most of the things that they were concerned with were the high cost of living in Guadeloupe, the high gasoline prices. This was when gasoline prices had spiked throughout the world,
mm-hmm.
and the high cost of food in the supermarket, of utilities, of public transportation, just basically high cost of living in general in Guadeloupe. And they asked for an audience with the prefect, but they were denied, and they kind of began building steam. And eventually they took on the name of the Lianage contre Profitation, Lianage being a kind of Creole word for a kind of community and a unity. And I talk about how it offered a kind of new model of community that is different from that of the nation state, and all kind of unity and difference that was that came to be through this coalition. And so they came up with this category of profitación to kind of describe all the economic, historical, political, colonial abuses of society. And profitación became this very capacious term that people really rallied around, and it kind of tapped into a kind of broader social frustrations in Guadeloupe. And so this was a massive movement of 45% of the population was physically in the streets marching.
Wow.
And polls suggest that 80% supported it. And they brought Guadeloupe to a halt for 44 days and were able to bring the French government to the table for negotiations and signed agreements on 120 different points of reform.
So in picking up on this, on the bringing the French to the table, and the signing of this agreement, in one sense, in that sort of dry labor study sense, this was massively successful. But on the other hand, there's a sense that you pick up when you're talking to people in Guadeloupe, that there was still a pretty great sense of disappointment with what had happened. Why were they so disappointed given what seems on paper to be a pretty successful general strike?
Yeah, so when I interview one of the main leaders of the movement, he says, oh, yes, we failed. We failed. Anywhere else, this would have led to the creation of a new government. And so I became interested in that idea and in why he thought they had failed at doing something that they hadn't even set out to do. they surpassed their expectations for what they set out to do, but yet somehow the general strike began to look like something like a national movement, a national revolution. And so it kind of hinted at, it awoke and stirred up those ties and those kind of attachments that people had to those political models. And so even though there had been a kind of generalized disenchantment with national revolution in Guadeloupe, somehow when it began to look like a national revolution, people were then disappointed when it didn't turn out that way. And so I argue that, the problem is that we don't have concepts with which to describe these alternative forms of politics, nor do we have measures of what of their success. So we have both the concepts and the measures of success and failure that are based on a previous era of political possibility and not on our current moment. And so I don't have a solution to that problem, but other than to kind of note its complications. But I do suggest that the banners in Guadeloupe at the end of the 2009 strike, they don't proclaim victory. They just say nothing will ever be the same again. And so I do argue that the 2009 strike, the LKP movement, it had a significant impact in Guadeloupean society, and that nothing will be the same again. That has now become a kind of new benchmark against which, you know, all social movements will be compared. But it still didn't displace previous expectations. And even though these new categories, Lianage and Profitation, entered into circulation, they still coexist with previous categories that right. at times dominate the political imagination to a greater extent.
So if we, you mentioned in the introduction, and you've spoken about it here today, the way that you believe that Guadeloupe and these sort of non-sovereign places actually speak to the nominally independent to conditions in the nominally independent Caribbean. Do you have any sense of what the forms of non-sovereign politics might look like in these nominally independent parts of the Caribbean?
Well, I don't, because I think that it will depend on each context. And sure. So in Guadeloupe, labor activism was this important fertile site. And so that's why a general strike was what could become possible there. And in a place like Puerto Rico, for example, at times the environmental movement has been very strong. And so there was the kind of the move to get the U.S. Navy out of Vieques, for example, was right. a kind of really significant moment that brought that in some ways tapped into that environmentalism to kind of clean up and deal with the environmental legacies and also public health legacies of having, you know, the Navy bombing site there. Struggles around the cost of living throughout the Caribbean are becoming important. The motto of La Vie Chere had also come out in Haiti, for example. And I mean, now throughout the United States, we're seeing the rise of this Black Lives Matter movement mm-hmm. that will certainly have resonances in the Caribbean, I'm sure. But I think in each place, there will be kind of different forms of contestation that find their own particular language with which to address these disappointments with independence, and in the U.S., disappointments with the civil rights movement, with the promises of inclusion. And so I think that kind of disenchantment is being channeled into different political forms dependent on the context. But we need to kind of remain attentive to these alternative political forms that at times don't meet up our expectations. So, for example, in the U.S. also there was Occupy Wall Street, right. which many saw as a kind of unfocused political movement. But I think it was very similar to the kind of politics that I witnessed in Guadeloupe as well.
Yeah, that's actually a really fascinating way to think about it. And also, I think you are right to note that this is something we should be paying attention to with this new framework of new sovereign politics in mind. So the final question for this morning, and I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. What are you working on now?
I am working on my next book is about Puerto Rico and about the statehood movement in Puerto Rico. So I describe it as a prequel to the Guadeloupe book.
Okay.
Yes, in the sense that we kind of already know what the story of integration looks like in Guadeloupe. But yeah, I'm interested in these folks in Puerto Rico who are imagining integration into the United States as a form of anti-colonial politics and a form of decolonization today.
Well, that sounds fascinating, and certainly will be an important work for people working really on any aspect of the Western Hemisphere. Jarmar, we want to thank you again for speaking with us. I've really enjoyed our interview. And once again, I think this is a really great book for people to read. I also think it's a great book for students, and I certainly am planning to start assigning it in my own classes. So thank you again for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was great fun.
And thank you all for listening to New Books in Caribbean Studies. Bye. You've been listening to New Books in Caribbean Studies. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time.